When Jesus heard it, he went away from there in a boat to a deserted spot by himself. The crowds heard it and followed him on foot from the towns. When he came out, he saw the large crowd. He was sorry for them. He healed their sick. When it was evening, the disciples came to him. "This is a deserted spot," they said, "and it's already getting late. Send the crowds away so that they can go into the villages and buy food for themselves." "They don't need to go away," said Jesus. "You give them something to eat." "All we have here," they said, "is 5 loaves of bread and 2 fish." "Bring them here to me," he said. He told the crowds to sit down on the grass. Then he took the 5 loaves and the 2 fish and looked up to heaven. He blessed the loaves, broke them, and gave them to the disciples. And then the disciples gave them to the crowds. Everybody ate and was satisfied, and they picked up 12 baskets full of broken pieces. There were about 5,000 men who had eaten, besides women and children. Jesus at once made the disciples get into the boat and go on ahead of him to the opposite shore while he dismissed the crowds.
After he'd sent the crowds away, Jesus went up to the mountain by himself to pray. When evening came, he was there by himself. The boat had already gone some distance from the shore and was being smashed around by the waves, since the wind was against it. At the very dead of night, he came towards them, walking on the water. The disciples saw him walking on the sea and panicked. "It's a ghost," they said, and they screamed in terror. But Jesus at once spoke to them. "Courage," he said. "It's me. Don't be frightened." "If it's really you, Master," said Peter in reply, "give me the word to come to you on the water." "Come along then," said Jesus. Peter got out of the boat and walked on the water and came towards Jesus. But when he saw the strong wind, he was afraid and began to sink. "Master," he yelled, "rescue me." Jesus at once reached out his hand and caught him. "A fine lot of faith you've got," he said. "Why did you doubt?" They got into the boat and the wind died down. The people in the boat worshiped him. "You really are God's son," they said.
It's been a week. I made 2 round trips to Boston, interviewed a bunch of candidates for ordained ministry, shared the grief of a beloved family, and got to have a birthday party. Well, not a birthday party. A birthday dinner. The interview part was with the Board of Ordained Ministry, and we gathered to interview 13 folk who are in the very long process of becoming ordained elders. And they're beginning what's called the provisional elder track, which is sort of like starting tenure track. And it'll be 3 or 5 or 6 or 8 years. Well, they'll continue training, and at the end of that, we'll interview them again. And they may, we pray, get approved. It's good work, and it's exhausting. And the entire time we were interviewing all these wonderful folk, there was a scared voice in the back of my head asking, "What is the point of this if in a month we find out that the United Methodist Church is not going to exist as a denomination anymore?" And I'll get back to that later. On Friday night, I got to take a break from board work, drive into Cambridge, and have a dinner with Barb and Micah and my daughter Chloe for her 21st birthday. We had a quick dinner because I had to get back north. Chloe had classes, all that stuff, but it was wonderful for that short hour we could be together. We went to a place in Cambridge, in Harvard Square, called the Hourly Oyster Bar, and that's about how long we were there. And yeah, it was about as pricey as you might think with a name like that. So it was Barb and me and our son Micah and Chloe and her boyfriend Tynan, and somehow in the midst of a conversation, bologna sandwiches came up, like you do. And Chloe asked, "What does bologna taste like?" And I was like, "What?" And then I realized that I don't think I've tasted bologna since high school. Who buys bologna anymore? No, you do, okay, sorry. So we had to settle on bologna tastes halfway between tofu Lin and a hot dog. And I realized that if I had been in, when I was 28 or 21, I had no clue what tofu Lin was at the time, but our kids lived on it. So, but wow, I thought, our daughter missed that defining experience of growing up, which was opening up a brown paper sack and taking out a room temperature Wonder Bread lettuce and mayonnaise bologna sandwich. I've been, school lunches. Everyone has school lunch stories, right?
Joanne likes it fried.
Joanne likes the fries. you might have a horror story about whatever horrible glop they served. Maybe a story of how we would open up our brown bag or our Partridge Family lunchbox. Yes, I had one. To see what mom put in there, and then maybe you'd trade your nice healthy apple or banana for the rich kid's 1/4 of a Twinkie, and you thought you were getting the better end of the bargain. My mom grew up in Gorham, Maine, and in the 1950s, it was the poor kids, the fishermen's kids, who had to suffer with lobster rolls in their brown bag lunches every day, while the better off kids had the bologna on Wonder Bread. I think the fishermen's kids would have been a little shocked to hear that their brown bag lunches would cost $28 at a Harvard Square restaurant today, and that nobody except Donna touches bologna ever. Oh, three, okay. Don't tell my old hermeneutics professor this, but I think brown bag lunches are the key to interpreting our gospel reading today. Matthew sets the feeding of the 5,000, which all four gospels share. It's the only miracle in the Gospels that all four Gospels share is the feeding of the 5,000. So every early Christian community whose oral tradition gave us the Gospels, they all knew that story. But in a twist, Matthew sets the feeding of the 5,000, which all four Gospels record, against the story of Jesus walking on the water, which all the Gospels except Luke records. And then Peter messing up trying to walk on the water, which only Matthew shares. Matthew sets this scene up right after the feeding of the 5,000. And it's on purpose. But why does he set the feeding of the 5,000 and Peter not walking on the water? Why does he set these cheek to jowl with each other? Well, the answer is brown bag lunches. No, really. One of the important things whenever we read about water in the New Testament, and in the Hebrew scriptures, this takes place around the Sea of Galilee, which is about the size of the broad lake of Lake Champlain, and similar in some ways. It's got mountains on both sides, or very tall hills on both sides, and it's fresh water. It's not really a sea. It should be Lake Gennesaret is one of the other names for it. But it's filled with water, like lakes are. And of all the elements of creation, water is the one that the Hebrews were most distrustful of and afraid of. Yam, which is the name for ocean water in Hebrew, represents the chaos of creation or pre-creation, the chaos that God used to create order. The tohu wabohu is the Hebrew, that wild and waste. That's what God subdued to bring order. But it was always still a little scary. Israel had no natural ports, and so they did not become a seafaring people. So even sailing on a lake like Galilee was a little nervous-making. There were no good sailors. And the only two large bodies of water in all of the Holy Land was the Dead Sea, which did not have a lot of fishing going on, and Galilee. Jesus grew up in that Hebrew tradition, and so did the disciples, and so they had a healthy nervousness about water. The fishermen among Jesus' disciples would have had a very healthy respect and fear of the powers of the Sea of Galilee. It is between two mountain ranges, and so when the winds whip up, they get focused and funneled, and it can get pretty wild and waste very, very quickly. And we have to understand that tradition of the chaos of the sea to understand the importance of that part of our reading. But then there's this first part about the feeding of the 5,000. Now, you've heard me preach a bunch of times on this text, so I'm not going to do all of it. I just want to highlight a few important details. In the Synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, the disciples seem to have the loaves and fishes on them when Jesus asks, "What do we got?" In John's Gospel, it's a kid. A kid had brought his brown bag lunch, which was 5 barley loaves and 2 fish. And it's an important hint, because barley loaves were the grain or the loaf of the poor. If you had money, you could get wheat loaves. If you were poor, you had barley loaves. They steal the kid's lunch. Or the kid very nicely offers his lunch. And Jesus blesses it and then has the people gather into small groups. The picture here doesn't really show that. And most of the times we see the pictures, paintings of artists' interpretations of the feeding of the 5,000 as just this sea of humanity. But Jesus organizes them into groups, into smaller groups that were bigger than just families. They couldn't be closed little units like this. People who didn't know each other had to gather in close with other people they didn't know. It was pretty uncomfortable, I suspect. They didn't know what to talk about. Maybe whispering, "How crazy is the rabbi? How loud is the rumbling in my stomach?" But then I wonder how many of them said something like, "Oh, you know, I brought a little brown bag. I have a few figs. It might round out the fish here. Would someone like some? Or I have a skin of wine, if anyone would like. Or shall I play my flute? I learned a new tune this week. Would you like to hear it?" And I wonder if soon strangers who didn't have a thing in common were talking like old friends, and soon strangers who thought they had brought nothing of worth were sharing in abundance. And soon total strangers were being transformed by 5 loaves and 2 fishes and 1 Lord. And soon 12 baskets of fish and bread were left over to give witness to the fact that something amazing, a brown bag miracle, had just happened there because of one kid's lunch that in Jesus' hands were enough. And then Matthew chunks in this story about Peter. They're out on the lake. And in my head, I only noticed it this time. I always thought of a storm. But the text doesn't say a storm. And I usually conflate this with some of the other storm on Galilee stories. But it doesn't say that. It just says it was windy. And it was wavy, and they were beating against the wind, and so there was a lot of beating on the boat. But this is what I told you that the lake was between two sets of hills. There's a thing in the evening called cataphatic winds. I remember I was sailing south of Vergennes, and I had no wind all day, doing a lot of paddling to get my sailboat to go, and trying to get to a camping spot across from Button Bay. And it had been just nothing all day long, and suddenly, out of nowhere, when I get past those palisades on the lake, it was about 20 minutes after sunset, and suddenly I had 15 knots of wind, just blew me, phew, a few miles down to the end of the cliffs and right to where I needed to go in to go camping. Those are called cataphatic winds, as when the sun sets, the cooling air up on top of the hills is dense and it comes down the hills and can get some pretty serious winds. In Patagonia, these are so fierce that they get hurricane strength when they come down off the Andes. They're fearsome. They're worse than hurricanes. So anyway, this is what they're rowing against. They've got a cataphatic wind in the evening. It's work, but it's not anything they haven't handled before. These guys have dealt with this. There is no fear mentioned at this point. They don't have fear, we're told, until Jesus shows up. And they think they're seeing a ghost. What does Jesus say to them while he's taking a stroll on the surface of Galilee? What does he say?
Don't be afraid.
Don't be afraid. It's actually one word in the Greek. I have no idea what it is in the Aramaic. And I like how N.T. Wright translates it here. He just said, has Jesus say, courage! Courage! The Greek is tharseo. And it sometimes is translated, don't fear, take heart. King James says, be of good cheer. Not something you say to guys who are beaten up against the waves. Oh, be of good cheer. Have a party. Courage. Courage. The thing the cowardly lion wanted, right? Courage. Courage is a great word that N.T. Wright uses. Rather than do not be afraid or do not fear, because courage is not the absence of fear, is it? Courage is having fear and yet acting anyway. Courage is having fear but doing what is necessary despite one's fear. A couple weeks ago on the radio show On Being, Krista Tippett was interviewing a blogger and activist named Glennon Doyle, and her wife, who is a soccer player, and I've forgotten her name.
Abby
Wambach, thank you. Glennon Doyle said that she defined courage as not being afraid of who you are. And she didn't go into any more detail. She just said that, dropped it, and went on. I'm like, oh my gosh, that needs to be dissected. Courage means not being afraid of who you are. And I think what she meant was that courage is reaching deep into the brown bag of your soul, into your truest self, and not being afraid of the abilities and the possibilities that you find in there, that reside in there, and taking that out and risking embarrassment, and risking ridicule, and risking failure, and risking rejection, and going ahead and doing it anyway. Courage means not being afraid of who you are. It's reaching into the brown bag and finding something good and risking acting on it. Now, as disciples of Jesus Christ, I wonder if we might have a slightly different take on that. I would say that courage is not being afraid of whose we are. I think it means reaching down into our own brown bag, down into our most authentic self, the part of you that most truly reflects your God-given nature, and finding something good. But there's another step. When we take that and we give that over to Jesus' will and way, it is transformed into something even greater, able to transform us and to transform the world around us into something that resembles the kingdom of God, the place where God's will is done on earth as it is in heaven. When we hand off what is good in us, we are transformed. So what I think Matthew was doing in putting these two stories up next to each other is that Matthew was contrasting what happens when we give that good thing over to Jesus' will and way, seeing how it is transformed into something even greater, able to change us, change the world around us, and to quote Paul in Ephesians, accomplish abundantly far more than all we could ask or imagine on our own. Matthew sets the feeding of the 5,000 against the story of Jesus walking on the water, and more important, Peter messing up trying to walk on water, because I think Matthew wants to contrast the courage of the crowd to open up their brown bags, offering up what they might have brought, offering it up to the will and way of Jesus, and discovering a miracle of generosity, of love, of caring and sharing that they did not and could not have on their own. And contrasting that with Peter, who, when he saw the waves, he found fear. Peter's awesome. When he sees Jesus and wants to, okay, it's not a ghost, take courage, cool. Peter is a whack job. I love him. He always is like, takes everything to the nth degree, acts without thinking. And so he sees Jesus walking and it's not, hey, cool job, bro. It's, let me do it too. And off he goes onto the water, and Peter the word is Petros, the Aramaic name. They would have called him Cephas or Kephas, which means stone or rock, and Petros the same thing, stone or rock. And everything is fine when Peter steps out onto the water and the waves, and he sees the waves, and he gets nervous. Well, he finds fear, and he sinks like a Petros. He sinks like a rock. Notice something important, because I've had it preached this way to me when I was little. Peter never loses faith in Jesus. He does not lose faith in Jesus. As he begins to sink, he cries out to him, "Save me!" He has faith in Jesus as his Savior. What he didn't do was open his own brown bag. Once he saw the waves and found fear, he closed that bag up and just depended on what he had. And what he had for walking on water was nothing. And down he went. It was like coyote and roadrunner physics. You know, the coyote runs off the cliff, and he's fine until he looks down and then goes, and that beautiful 10-second drops down at the bottom. Yeah, I think Peter was feeling like that. I want to go back to the question that was in my head when we were interviewing candidates for ordained ministry. Why on earth would you want to risk getting connected to a denomination that after our national or international meeting at the end of the month may split the denomination? Just as we split the denomination in the early 1800s around slavery. And the Southern Church saying, we know how to read Scripture. We are positive the way God operates. We know how Jesus operates and knows exactly what we're supposed to do, and that is own slaves. And folk up here saying, well, not so fast. Today we have a large swath of the church saying, we know exactly what God says and exactly how we're supposed to operate, and God says, don't ordain gay people. And don't marry gay people. Tell them they can come in and be celibate. Or tell them to come in and you can't be in ministry. Tell them to come in, but we will not serve you like we serve everybody else. And we may split over that. My friend Becca Garrell, who followed me at Trinity Montpelier a long time ago, did ask some of the folks that she interviewed, why on earth are you jumping on board with a denomination that may not exist? And she wrote a piece that I put in our Facebook page yesterday. What is there to say about why anyone would want to serve in the New England Annual Conference of the United Methodist Church in this time? I could start with what our candidates said this week. Many of us asked them, why would you join the UMC at this particular moment? And they said things like, because this is an exciting time to serve. And this is an exciting mission field. It's because ministry is always a leap of faith in trusting God in the face of uncertainty. Why is this any different? Because maybe, quoting Esther, God has called me for such a time as this. And Becca said this after we approved 12 of our 13 candidates. She wrote this. This year, we are recommending for commissioning, provisional membership, and ordination the largest class in my memory. About a dozen to be ordained, those are the folks we interviewed in the fall, and a dozen to be commissioned and welcomed as provisional members. The class is multilingual. They are fluent in Spanish, Portuguese, English, Korean, and Chinese. I will not even begin to describe, she said, the racial and ethnic diversity this class embodies, since I would probably leave something out and definitely collapse people's complex identities into a category. Suffice it to say that their hair is coarse and fine and wavy and tightly curled and straight and long and short and thinning and non-existent, and it is brown, black, blonde, ginger, and electric blue. There are at least 3 impressive beards, and we don't even know how many tattoos. They come from diverse theological and educational backgrounds and experiences. Some are very young but wise, and some have former careers that span decades and disciplines. They are serving in every state in New England, and they are from all over the country and from all around the world. None of them are lifelong Methodists. They are not all straight. They are definitely not all business as usual. And this is what I really like to hear. Between them, they are planting or launching 3 new churches. Yeah, in New England, I know. And 1 restart. They are involved in 4 language or immigrant community-specific ministries, practice at least 2 radically non-traditional ministry models, including dinner church, and strategized two plans to repurpose old historic downtown church buildings. Their ministry in the church is creative and messy and inspiring and prayerful and steep in tradition and breaking the molds. Beyond the local church, they serve in homeless shelters and hospitals, retirement communities and coffee shops, biker bars, recovery cabarets, yoga, and other missionary settings. And this is what she finished up with. We are not witnessing the death of the Methodist movement in New England or in the world. We are witnessing its metamorphosis. We are witnessing resurrection. If you read a lot of Methodistica online, you have heard wailing and gnashing of teeth and pearl clutching over what's going to happen next month. And I have to say, I'm not sweating it. I'm really not. I don't know what's going to happen to United Methodism, but here's the thing. God will always have the church. God will always raise up a church. Denominations are not in the Bible, but God will always raise up a church. And a church is a community of people who have the courage to reach into the brown bag of faith and find their most intimate, God-given talents. God-given hearts, generosity, hearts, minds, and souls can take that out and offer it to a God of transformation and resurrection, so that we can be about being transformed ourselves, so that we might be about the transformation of the world. What is called in the Hebrew tradition, tikkun, the repair of the world. I've been with you all for a dozen years. You are church. Brothers and sisters, you are church, not a church. That's what we usually call the building. You are church, and you do church, because you all are willing to reach deep down into the brown bag. You've probably come up with something better than an eviscerated duck. You find that part of you that is made in the image of God, and you offer it up to Jesus, and you are made new. And I pray that whatever comes out of February will be new, that God can do something amazing with it. There's a prayer from Ghana I want to close with. And I think we as church, we as a denomination need to remember. The prayer from Ghana says, "Journeying God, pitch your tent with mine, so that I may not become deterred by hardship, strangeness, doubt. Show me the movement I must make toward a wealth not dependent on possessions, toward a wisdom not based on books, toward a strength not bolstered by might, toward a God not confined to heaven. Help me to find myself as I walk in others' shoes."